Well, welcome to these talks. We're going to have two sessions, and we're going to be looking, first of all, at John Wycliffe, the English reformer, this morning, and that will probably actually run over into the afternoon session. And then we'll go on to look at John Huss, the disciple of Wycliffe and the Bohemian reformer. So let's begin with John Wycliffe. Now, John Wycliffe was born, well, we're not sure where and we're not quite sure when. Modern scholarship tends towards the year 1330 as his date of birth. Now, the place is more tricky. The 16th century writer John Leland, who lived in the reign of Henry VIII, tells us that Wycliffe was born at Spreswell, a mile from Richmond in Yorkshire. But rather confusingly, Leland also tells us that Wycliffe came from the village of Wycliffe on the River Tees, some 10 miles from Richmond. And historians have struggled to reconcile these statements. And it's made even trickier by the fact that there is actually no such place as a Spreswell, a mile from Richmond. So to solve this enigma, some have suggested that Spreswell is a typographical error for Ipswell, or Hipswell, a village that does indeed exist quite close to Richmond, and that seems to be a reasonable solution. As to the connection with the village of Wycliffe, it's been argued that this was the ancestral seat of Wycliffe's family, even though he wasn't born there. And certainly a family named Wycliffe had been lords of the manor there ever since the Norman conquest. Now, there's no hard evidence to prove that John Wycliffe belonged to this Norman family that shared his name, but many historians accept the likelihood that he did. Well, without going into the details of this complex debate, I think we can be reasonably content to accept that Wycliffe was a Yorkshireman, that he was probably born at Ipswell, or Hipswell, and that he probably belonged to the Wycliffe family that ruled the village of Wycliffe on the River Tees. Now that immediately brings us to another mystery, and that is that we're not sure how to spell Wycliffe's name. One German scholar classified 30 variations. Normally one of two spellings is opted for, either W-Y-C-L-I-F or W-Y-C-L-I-S-S. Both of those are well attested, and they're both found in history textbooks. So Wycliffe, the man of mystery. When was he born? Where was he born? How do you spell his name? And he continues to be mysterious in his early life, about which we know almost nothing. At some point, he went to Oxford University, probably Balliol College, and there he trained for the priesthood. Wycliffe indeed spent almost all his time at Oxford University, both learning and teaching. Mostly he was based in Queen's College from 1363 onwards. By 1366 he was a Bachelor of Divinity, and in 1372 he became a Doctor of Divinity. He held a number of livings in the church. He was the rector of Sillingham, Ludgers Hall, and Lutterworth. But until the end of his career, he left these parishes in the care of a curate so that he could devote himself to scholarly pursuits at Oxford. And certainly Wycliffe seems to have felt very much at home in Oxford University. During his last days at Lutterworth, he once burst forth into a nostalgic song of praise for the landscape of Oxford, its woods and its river, which shows how much he appreciated its natural beauty. Unfortunately, again, we know little of Wycliffe's activities in Oxford before he became involved in politics around 1370, by which time he already had a reputation as an outstanding thinker. How he achieved that reputation and the development of his ideas prior to 1370 are all part of the mystery of John Wycliffe. One thing, though, is clear from the testimony of his contemporaries, and it's this. Wycliffe became Oxford University's most celebrated philosopher and theologian. And since Oxford University at that time was one of Europe's greatest intellectual institutions, that says a lot for Wycliffe, that he became its greatest intellectual. And it also explains why the papacy took it so seriously when a man of Wycliffe's stature, the greatest intellectual of one of Europe's greatest universities, began criticizing the doctrines and practices of the medieval church. Criticism from such a source could not be ignored. In today's terms, it might be rather as if, in one of America's greatest universities, a teacher of political science, who was world famous for his writings and his acknowledged talents, embarked on a radical crusade against the American president and his staff and their policies, subjecting them to regular and withering criticism as betrayers of the American Constitution. Now, the effect and the resonance which that might have today gives us some feeling of how Wycliffe's critique of the papacy and the institutional church was received back in his day. Maybe that's the point at which to look at those first two portraits there, two of the most well-known portraits of Wycliffe. He always seems to be depicted as a bearded man and holding that rod or staff. We may, however, be surprised to find Wycliffe as a great philosopher as well as a great theologian. Why would an evangelical reformer and preacher be a philosopher? So perhaps a word of explanation will be useful in that regard. In our society today, theology and philosophy have to a great extent gone their separate ways. Most philosophers are not theologians, and most theologians are not philosophers. Now, that's largely due to the increasing gulf between, on the one hand, our society's understanding of itself, and on the other hand, the Christian faith. Now, when that kind of gulf springs up, philosophy and theology are bound to diverge. Philosophy, in one shape or another, has been an accepted part of human culture in the Western world ever since the great days of Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle in Athens, the intellectual capital of Greece in the centuries before Christ. So, when a society abandons Christianity as its public faith, the great cultural pursuit known as philosophy becomes increasingly the province of non-Christian ideas and non-Christian systems of thought. But it was not so in Wycliffe's day. The situation was quite different then. Whatever problems we may have with the official Christianity of 14th century Europe, and Wycliffe himself was to have very serious problems, as we'll see, that shouldn't allow us to miss the basic fact that Christianity, not secular humanism, not the New Age, not Islam, but Christianity, was the official public faith of European society at that time. The culture of Wycliffe's day understood itself through the medium of fundamental Christian beliefs about God and the world and human destiny. Now, that being the case, philosophy in 14th century Europe was something that was pursued within the setting of a Christian view of life. And in fact, so much was that the case that our distinction between philosophy and theology didn't really quite exist in Wycliffe's day. Generally speaking, back then, the two subjects blended and merged and mingled with each other. The great philosophers were theologians, and the great theologians were philosophers. The real difference between philosophy and theology back then was that philosophy was more concerned with what could be known or discovered through human reason, whereas theology was more concerned with what could be known only through divine revelation, as that revelation was to be found in the scriptures and in the teaching of the church. But both philosophy and theology were done by men who, like Wycliffe, professed the Christian faith from within a Christian view of life. And philosophy and theology impacted on each other, much as today the different sciences impact on each other. You can't keep the sciences in watertight compartments. Physics, chemistry, biology, they all act and react on each other. And it was something like that with philosophy and theology in medieval Europe, so that it would not necessarily have been very easy to see where one ended and the other began. Wycliffe, therefore, would have seen himself, and he would have been seen as a Christian thinker, whether he was dealing with philosophy or whether he was dealing with theology. Now, the kind of theology that Wycliffe would have studied and taught at Oxford University is what's called scholastic theology. Scholastic theology. Now, the word scholastic there simply comes from the word school. School theology. And that was just another way of describing a university in the Middle Ages. So scholastic theology, school theology, really means university theology, as practiced in medieval Europe. A scholastic theologian was also called a schoolman, a university man. Now, as well as being theologians, the schoolmen were, as I've said, also the philosophers of the Middle Ages. So they wanted to give a comprehensive account, not just of the teaching of the church, but of all truth. And so they didn't limit themselves, they didn't restrict themselves to theological questions. They would try to answer deep philosophical questions as well. Things like, what is matter? What is mind? What is time? What is space? What is being? What is the nature of cause and effect? That sort of thing. Now, Wycliffe was thoroughly steeped in that way of thinking, and he gave his own answers to some of these questions. He didn't see this as useless philosophical speculation. He regarded it as part and parcel of his duty as a Christian thinker to tackle the basic questions of existence. Well, now let's move on to ask ourselves who the main people might have been who influenced the younger Wycliffe in his formative period before he rose to national and international fame around about 1370. Who were the men who influenced him? Well, among figures from Wycliffe's own distant past, the man who influenced him most was undoubtedly Augustine. Augustine of Hippo, the early church father of the 5th century. Now, this isn't the place to retell the story of Augustine. Suffice it to say that one of his most enduring legacies to the Western medieval church was his immensely influential exposition of the sovereignty of God in the salvation of sinners. Now, Augustine hammered out these views in his long controversy with Pelagius. His followers, the Pelagians, who denied the doctrine of original sin and upheld human free will as the decisive factor in salvation. So when the word Augustinian is used in theology, it generally refers to a belief that divine grace is unconditional and sovereign in the predestination and salvation of sinful human beings. Perhaps the word that would most readily spring to our lips would be the word Calvinist. But of course Augustine got there first, 1,000 years before Calvin. And Calvin regarded himself as nothing other than a humble disciple of Augustine. Well, John Wycliffe also falls into that same category. And it's very interesting and significant that the theology of Augustine underwent something of a revival, a renaissance, in the last two centuries of the medieval period. This was as various thinkers of that time reacted against the teachings of an English scholastic theologian William of Ockham. Ockham's theology was seen by many as being little better than Pelagianism, and Ockham's critics set forth a revived and a renewed Augustinianism as the answer to what Ockham was saying. And Wycliffe stands very much in that stream of Augustinian revival and Renaissance. And in that way, as well as in others, Wycliffe foreshadowed the Reformation teaching of Luther and Calvin. So Augustine, undoubtedly, the greatest influence on Wycliffe from Wycliffe's own past. Now, one great English medieval figure who it's thought may well have influenced Wycliffe was Robert Grosseteste. Robert Grosseteste, and his dates are 1168 to 1253. He is usually remembered today as a pioneer scientist, one of the figures in the Middle Ages who began the whole movement that eventually led to modern science. Now, Grosseteste's name, incidentally, means big head, which may not endear him to us. Robert Bighead. But if Grosseteste was big-headed, it was more in the greatness of his mind than his ego. We don't know much about Grosseteste's early life, but in 1235 he became Bishop of Lincoln. Now, that was the English bishopric with the largest territory. And as Bishop of Lincoln, Grosseteste devoted himself with great energy to reforming life and conduct among his clergy and people alike. He particularly insisted on the clergy's duty to preach the scriptures and the people's duty to come and listen to the word of God. Grosseteste himself was a great preacher, and he preached in English, not Norman French. So determined was he to bring the gospel to ordinary, uneducated people who couldn't understand Norman French but could understand English. Grosseteste said, "The work of a priest is not giving people the mass, but preaching the living truth." Well, Grosseteste's zeal for reforming the church catapulted him into a long and bitter conflict with the papacy. He protested passionately against Pope Innocent IV's appointment of spiritually unfit Italian friends and relatives, even little boys, to money-making positions in the English church. Grosseteste's disgust at the corruptions of the papal court provoked him into explosions of condemnation. He accused Pope Innocent IV of being an antichrist and predicted his eternal damnation in the hereafter. Grosseteste enjoyed such a universal reputation for holiness and intellectual brilliance that Pope Innocent dared not discipline him for these outbursts. But when Grosseteste died, Innocent exclaimed, "I rejoice, and let every true son of the Roman Church rejoice with me, that my great enemy is removed." Well, obviously, Grosseteste's dates, he died 80 years before John Wycliffe was born, rule out the possibility that he had any direct personal influence on Wycliffe. But Wycliffe could hardly have been unaware of his great reforming predecessor, and some historians have felt that Wycliffe may well have been encouraged by the example of Grosseteste as a reformer. It's also interesting that Wycliffe embraced the same view as Grosseteste concerning the relative merits of preaching and the sacraments. Certainly, as far as English evangelicals were to be concerned, Grosseteste came to be seen as a precursor of John Wycliffe, and ultimately a precursor of English Protestantism, owing to Grosseteste's commitment to biblical preaching and his outspoken opposition to a corrupt papacy. Also, the life of a man like Robert Grosseteste does remind us, I think, to be cautious about taking an overly pessimistic view of the medieval church. It wasn't all darkness because there were men like Grosseteste around. Now, quite often in Protestant literature, the young Wycliffe is said to have been a disciple of Archbishop Thomas Brad Wardin. And Brad Wardin's dates are 1290 to 1349. Thomas Brad Wardin was Professor of Theology at Oxford University, chaplain to King Edward III. Picture of King Edward III there. Well, it's a picture of his stone effigy, to be strictly accurate. Brad Wardin, a chaplain to King Edward III. And briefly, he was Archbishop of Canterbury for 40 days in 1349 before dying of the Black Death, which was then sweeping across Europe. Now, Brad Wardin published an important book in the year 1344, a book entitled Concerning the Cause of God Against Pelagius. Concerning the Cause of God Against Pelagius. And this book reveals Brad Wardin as one of the medieval church's greatest Augustinian theologians. He expounds and defends Augustine's doctrine of the sovereignty of God's grace in human salvation. The book earned Brad Wardin the nickname the Profound Teacher. And I think it reminds us again that we should resist the temptation to paint the medieval church in totally dark colours, as though all truth was lost until a Wycliffe or a Luther came along. If a man like Thomas Brad Wardin, whom incidentally the hymn writer Augustus Toplady regarded as the greatest English theologian of all time, if a man like Brad Wardin could rise to become Archbishop of Canterbury, it seems clear that for all its faults and all its defects, the medieval church was still capable of providing a home for great and godly minds. What about Archbishop Brad Wardin's influence then on John Wycliffe? Well, certainly, Wycliffe's own theology has a striking affinity to that of Brad Wardin. Like the Archbishop, Wycliffe too was to be a zealous believer in the sovereignty of grace. While, however, it may be true that Wycliffe owed a lot theologically to Brad Wardin, there's no overwhelming evidence that he ever studied personally under the great Archbishop. It seems more likely that any influence of Brad Wardin on Wycliffe was through the writings of Brad Wardin rather than through direct personal contact. So we've got Augustine, Grosseteste, Brad Wardin. And then finally, in this examination of the influences on Wycliffe, there's the figure of Richard Fitzralph. Richard Fitzralph. His dates are 1295 to 1360, and he was the Archbishop of Armagh. Now, Fitzralph was both a scholastic theologian and a noted preacher. And in 1332, he became Chancellor of Oxford University. He was deeply committed to the advancement of learning among the clergy. Now, in Fitzralph's case, we know for a fact that he did influence John Wycliffe. We're no longer speculating here. It's a historical fact. He influenced Wycliffe. Towards the end of his life, Fitzralph became involved in controversy against the friars, chiefly the Franciscans and the Dominicans. And his bone of contention with them was their practice of begging for a living. Now, Fitzralph condemned this as contrary to the teaching of Christ. And he formulated his views in a treatise entitled Concerning the Salvation of the Poor. In this treatise, Fitzralph sets forth his views about voluntary poverty, possession of property, lordship, and the state of grace. These views had a profound impact on John Wycliffe, and Wycliffe took them up and reproduced them vigorously in his own conflict with the institutional church. So those then are some of the influences that went into forming the mind and the outlook of Wycliffe. That brings us to Wycliffe's own emergence onto the stage of national and international affairs. Sometime in the late 1360s or thereabouts, Wycliffe became a religious advisor to the court of the English king, Edward III, who reigned from 1327 to 77, a very long reign. Now, this connection between Wycliffe and the English court seems to have been because Wycliffe had developed theological views which the English monarchy and the English nobility found useful in their own political conflict with the papacy. This conflict revolved around the papacy's claim to own England. Now, such a claim may seem preposterous to us, but it was based on the fact that King John had indeed surrendered England to Pope Innocent III in the year 1213, in return for being restored to the Pope's favour after a long-running dispute which almost cost John his throne. Well, now, 150 years after, King Edward and his nobles keenly contested King John's right to do what he had done. They argued that John had had no right to place the kingdom under tribute to a foreign power without the consent of the whole kingdom as expressed in Parliament. So the Parliament of 1366 accordingly refused the demand of Pope Urban V for back payment of England's tribute to the papacy, which was now 33 years overdue. Now, alas, the mystery factor strikes again at this point. There seems to be no agreement among historians whether it was in 1366 that Wycliffe was launched into his career as a political celebrity, or whether it was 8 years later in 1374. So there's just no agreement about that. But whichever date it was in the context of this struggle between England and the papacy that Wycliffe made his first contribution on the national scene. Wycliffe wrote a treatise on the subject of this conflict between England and the papacy. And in this treatise, he gives a report of the speeches of a number of English nobles against the Pope's demand for tribute. In the summer of 1374, Wycliffe went to Bruges as a member of a royal commission to negotiate peace with France. This was the period of the so-called Hundred Years' War between England and France. That was from 1337 to 1453. So Wycliffe went as part of this team to negotiate peace with France, and at the same time he went in order to negotiate with the papacy on problems affecting the English church. Now, it's at this point, while Wycliffe is in Bruges as part of this royal commission, that we first find him associated with the great English noble John of Gaunt, the Duke of Lancaster. He was the younger son of King Edward III and the younger brother of Edward the Black Prince. Picture of the Black Prince there. I couldn't find a picture of John of Gaunt. Now, John of Gaunt is an important figure in English history. As well as playing a significant part as a warrior in the Hundred Years' War, he was one of the most powerful politicians in England. And indeed, his son, Henry, would seize the English throne in 1399 as King Henry IV, the first monarch of the House of Lancaster. John of Gaunt was also the patron of the great poet Geoffrey Chaucer, author of the Canterbury Tales. In 1376, the growing resentment against the wealth and corruption of the English church hierarchy finally boiled over in the Parliament of that year, which has gone down in history as the Good Parliament. There seems, during this period, to have been a widespread hostility among Englishmen to the higher ranks of the clergy. Ordinary priests, friars, and lay people alike denounced them as corrupt, greedy, and immoral. English writers of this time, such as Geoffrey Chaucer and William Langland, who wrote the poem Piers the Ploughman, certainly paint a rather unedifying picture of English church life in general. Now, Wycliffe was fully involved in the agitation against abuses in the church. One chronicler of this particular period portrays Wycliffe as running about from place to place, barking against the church. John of Gaunt headed up a movement to confiscate the property of the church, and Wycliffe provided John with a doctrinal theory in order to justify this. So let's have a look at what Wycliffe was saying. Based at least partly on his studies of Archbishop FitzRalph and his teaching, Wycliffe put forward a doctrine of dominion or lordship. And he argued that God is the only source of true authority. God has delegated a portion of his authority over secular things to the state and over spiritual things to the institutional church. However, said Wycliffe, human rulers can exercise this delegated authority only on condition that they faithfully serve God, the true Lord. And if they do not faithfully serve God, then they lose their right to lordship. It's a very crude summary of what Wycliffe was saying. Now, that may seem a doctrine calculated to incite revolution, with the oppressed taking up arms to overthrow all political authorities that are held to be oppressive. Wycliffe certainly didn't intend that. And, in fact, in the secular realm, he counseled submission to existing authority. He was, however, more of a revolutionary in applying his theory to the institutional church. If bishops fail to live pure and blameless lives, Wycliffe said, then the state, which has dominion over secular things, is entitled to strip the bishops of their official property and possessions. Now, this idea appealed very strongly to the English nobility, who were only too eager to seize the vast assets of the English church, especially when the church was deemed to be corrupt. Well, such dangerous ideas from the internationally famous lecturer of Oxford University could not be left unchallenged. So, acting on behalf of the church, Bishop Courtney of London summoned Wycliffe to appear before his tribunal at St. Paul's in London on February 1377 to answer for his views. The protection of John of Gaunt, however, prevented Bishop Courtney from harming Wycliffe. In fact, the tribunal witnessed a ferocious quarrel between John of Gaunt and Bishop Courtney. At the opening of the tribunal, the question arose as to whether Wycliffe should stand or be seated. The Lord Marshal of England, Lord Percy, told Wycliffe to sit down. Bishop Courtney protested and told him to stand up. John of Gaunt lost his temper and declared that he would bring down Courtney's pride and the pride of all the bishops of England. Do your best, sir, Courtney retorted. The proceedings degenerated into uproar, and John of Gaunt, who had outraged a good number of people with his vulgar disrespect for the bishop, was forced to retire, taking Wycliffe with him. And so in this rather unseemly way, the case against Wycliffe collapsed. The pressure on Wycliffe was increased in May 1377. Pope Gregory XI, no less, summoned the Oxford lecturer to appear in Rome within 30 days, charged with 19 deadly errors. Wycliffe refused to go. Political events in England had propelled his protector, John of Gaunt, into a temporary position of supremacy. King Edward III died in June 1377, and his young grandson, Richard II, the son of the deceased Black Prince, succeeded to the English throne, aged only 10. That's a picture of Richard II in his adulthood, but he was only 10 when he actually became king. Well, with the new king, not yet even a teenager, John of Gaunt became the most powerful man in the kingdom, so Wycliffe was safe. When Archbishop Sudbury of Canterbury tried to put Wycliffe on trial in January 1378, a mob of London citizens who supported Wycliffe broke up the meeting. The theology tutors of Oxford University also supported Wycliffe at this time. They declared to be true the 19 propositions that Pope Gregory XI had extracted from Wycliffe's writings as erroneous. Well, in March 1378, Pope Gregory XI died. The attempt of the cardinals to elect a new pope became a catastrophic fiasco and worked in Wycliffe's favour. What happened was this. From 1309 until 1377, the year before the death of Pope Gregory XI, the papacy had actually not been based in Rome, but in the French city of Avignon. Pope Gregory XI had taken the papacy back to Rome in the last year of his reign. But with Gregory XI now dead, the French cardinals would gladly have gone back to Avignon. The Roman population, however, was determined to keep the papacy in Rome and demanded an Italian pope. And so, pressurized by a Roman mob, the cardinals elected Urban VI. He was an Italian who wanted to liberate the papacy from French control. But a few months after Urban's election to the papacy, 12 of the 16 cardinals declared that the election was null and void because it had been carried out under threat of popular violence. They then proceeded to have another election, and they chose a Frenchman as Pope, Clement VII. Clement and his French cardinals then returned to Avignon and set up court there. But Urban VI and his supporters stayed in Rome. So, there were now two rival popes, Urban VI and Clement VII, and they proceeded to excommunicate each other. Now, since there was no higher authority in the church above a pope who had been elected by the cardinals, that meant there was no power that could choose between them. This rending asunder of the Catholic Church is known as the Great Schism. Catholic Europe was split down the middle. The Roman Pope, Urban VI, won the support of northern and central Italy, England, Scandinavia, and most of Germany. The Avignonese Pope, Clement VII, had the backing of France, Spain, southern Italy, Scotland, and some parts of Germany. So Europe really split down the middle. Urban VI died in 1389, and the Roman line of popes carried on, with Boniface XI, Innocent VII, Gregory XII. In Avignon, Clement VII was succeeded by Benedict XIII. The visible unity of the Catholic Church was destroyed, and the situation dragged on for nearly 40 years. Well, in the aftermath of this great schism, with the prestige of the papacy in tatters, Wycliffe's theology began to become more radical. He published a book called The Truth of Holy Scripture. Now, in this book, Wycliffe argues that the Bible is the only authoritative source of Christian doctrine, by which believers must test all the teachings of the institutional church, including the early church fathers, the papacy, and ecumenical councils. All Christians, said Wycliffe, should read the Bible, so it must be translated from the Latin of the Vulgate into the native languages of the various nations. Let me give you a quotation from Wycliffe from this treatise. Christian men and women, old and young, should study fast in the New Testament, and no simple man of wit should be afeared unmeasurably to study in the text of Holy Writ. Pride and covetousness of clergy is cause of their blindness and heresy, and depriveth them from very understanding of Holy Writ. The New Testament is of full authority, and open to understanding of simple men, as to the points that be most needful for salvation. The text of Holy Writ be words of everlasting life, and he that keepeth meekness and charity hath the true understanding and perfection of all Holy Writ. It seemeth open heresy to say that the gospel, with his truth and freedom, sufficeth not to salvation of Christian men, without keeping of ceremonies and statutes of sinful men, that be made in the time of Satan and Antichrist. Now, Wycliffe's views here really were quite radical for his time. In the Middle Ages, in Western Europe, people had come to regard the Bible as the book of the clergy. Priests and theologians alone could interpret it correctly, and then teach lay people what it meant. The Catholic Church looked with great suspicion, or even outright hostility, on the idea that a lay person should study the Bible for himself. The French Council of Toulouse in 1229 had actually forbidden the laity to read the Bible, either in the Latin of the Vulgate, because all educated people could understand Latin, or in a translation into any native tongue of Europe. Now, the thing that lay behind this opposition of the institutional church to lay Bible study was basically the anti-Catholic interpretations of Scripture made by various dissenting movements within medieval Europe, notably the Waldensians, who you may have heard of, one of the great pre-Reformation evangelical movements in Italy. Well, despite this official hostility to lay Bible reading, some scholars nevertheless had made a number of translations, either of the whole Bible or parts of it, into some of the native languages of Western Europe. One of Wycliffe's arguments for translating the Bible into English was that it had already been translated into French. Now, it was, in fact, only in the 1360s that English started to become the national language of England's ruling and educated classes. From 1066 onwards, the Norman conquest, the official language had been French, owing to the influence of the Norman background of William the Conqueror and his French-speaking nobles, who'd invaded and conquered England in that year. The English language, however, began to make something of a comeback in the 1360s, the English language being the language of the great mass of ordinary people who didn't speak or understand Norman French. In 1362, the English Parliament ordered that all legal proceedings henceforth must be conducted in English, on the grounds that French was much unknown. So Wycliffe's demand for an English Bible can be seen as part of this wider revival of the English language that was taking place at this period. Now, it wasn't that translating the Bible into English solved all the problems, because most ordinary people were illiterate. They couldn't read at all. Still, if the Bible was translated into their native tongue, they could at least listen to the Bible being read out to them, even if they couldn't read it themselves. So that was Wycliffe's treatise on the truth of Holy Scripture, the first of his great treatises as a reformer. Later on, in 1378, Wycliffe wrote another important book entitled On the Church. This book reveals him as a devout disciple of Augustine. Wycliffe defines the church, not in terms of some outward organization, controlled by papacy and priesthood, but as the whole body of the elect, those eternally predestined to salvation by the pure grace of God. And if from the standpoint of eternity, the church is the whole body of the elect, on earth, at any given point in time, the church is the entire company of true believers from every land. So, says Wycliffe, the church is a spiritual and an invisible body, rooted and grounded in the eternal predestination of God, infallibly known to God alone, and its head is not the Pope, its head is Jesus Christ himself. The Pope, says Wycliffe, can only be the head of the outward and visible congregation that exists in the city of Rome, which is made up both of the elect and the non-elect. The following year, 1379, Wycliffe wrote another great reforming treatise, The Power of the Pope. The Power of the Pope. Now in this treatise, Wycliffe argues that the papacy is of human origin, not divine origin. And he denies that the Pope has any legitimate authority over any secular government. If a particular Pope imitates the Apostle Peter by living a holy and humble life, well, he can then claim to exercise the authority of Peter. But a Pope who does not follow Christ is Antichrist. Later on, Wycliffe decided that all Popes, not just the bad ones, are Antichrist. But then in 1380 came Wycliffe's boldest stroke. He now attacked the Catholic doctrine of Holy Communion in his book On the Eucharist. On the Eucharist. Wycliffe, in this book, rejects the doctrine of transubstantiation. And he goes back to the earlier views of Augustine and the 9th century theologian Retramnus. According to Wycliffe, the bread and wine of Holy Communion remain bread and wine in their own nature. Their substance or essence is not miraculously changed or converted into the body and blood of Christ. Christ's body as a physical object, says Wycliffe, is in heaven at the right hand of God, not on earth. However, Christ's body, he says, is present in the bread and wine in a spiritual manner. The bread and wine are not bare and naked signs alone. They are what Wycliffe calls effective and efficacious signs which convey Christ to the believer. Wycliffe used the following illustration. The soul of a human being is truly present in his body. But if an animal ate a man's body, the animal's mouth would not thereby consume the man's soul. Likewise, says Wycliffe in Holy Communion, the believer, and only the believer, truly feeds on the body and blood of Jesus Christ as he eats the bread and as he drinks the wine. But he does not receive Christ's life-giving flesh in some crude physical way into his mouth. Rather, he receives it in a mystical and spiritual way into his soul through faith. The true view of the Eucharist, Wycliffe argues, had vanished from the Western Church since the 11th century, but was still preserved in the Eastern Church. Now, the Eastern Church believed in the real presence of Christ in the bread and wine more strongly than Wycliffe did, it would have to be said, but the Eastern Church had never accepted the Western doctrine of transubstantiation. And it was that doctrine that Wycliffe was basically attacking, with its philosophical distinction between substance and accidents, and the idea that the accidents, the appearance of bread and wine could remain when their substance no longer existed. Wycliffe entirely rejected this theory. Now, this wasn't the only appeal that Wycliffe made to the Eastern Church. He also held it up as an example in some other matters, for example, allowing the clergy to marry. And so John Wycliffe began the great tradition among Western reformers of using the Eastern Church as a weapon with which to attack the corruptions of Rome. It was a brilliant strategy, because in many disputed matters, if Rome claimed that it had the ancient practice of the church on its side, a reformer could simply point to the Eastern Church and say, but they're as ancient as you, and they don't do this, or they don't believe this. Well, by official Catholic standards, Wycliffe's attack on the doctrine of transubstantiation had now made him into a dangerous heretic. The English court and nobility, including John of Gaunt, now broke off their support for him. This reaction against Wycliffe was intensified by the great peasants' revolt, which broke out in England in 1381, and which for a time threatened to carry all before it, and Wycliffe unjustly became associated with the anarchy of the peasants' revolt. This was the revolt that was spearheaded by Wat Tyler, you may have heard of him, and whose main issue was the poll tax, the introduction of a poll tax. Some things obviously don't change over time. Non-payment of the poll tax was widespread, and the most common way for peasants to avoid paying was to lie about the number of their family members. So the government applied stricter measures of collection, and this was the spark that ignited the rebellion. The first known outbreak of violence occurred in the town of Brentwood in Essex County. When officials tried to collect the tax, the town and people rioted, killing 6 people. After that incident, violence then spread through the rest of Essex and into Kent as well. Dissidents, both from Essex and Kent, began to march on London in an attempt to address the king and air their grievances against the poll tax. As well as the leadership that was supplied by Wat Tyler, who seems to have had some military background, another notable leader in the peasants' revolt was a priest from Kent, John Ball, who had been a social agitator for many years. Ball believed passionately in social equality and Christian democracy. He preached to the rebels and circulated letters around the countryside advocating unity and discipline among the peasants. Well, in London, the rebels managed to capture and kill Archbishop Sudbury of Canterbury. Among their demands were the abolition of the poll tax, the abolition of serfdom, and the redistribution of church property to the poor. The revolt was, however, crushed. Wat Tyler was killed in action, and John Ball was executed for treason. Now, there is no evidence whatever that Wycliffe supported the peasants' revolt. And indeed, in the aftermath of the revolt, when it had been crushed, Wycliffe advocated that church property should be given to the nobility, not to the poor. So there's simply no evidence that he was in any sense in favour of the peasants' revolt. Wycliffe was not a social revolutionary. Nevertheless, the victorious church and nobility did lay some of the blame on Wycliffe for the peasants' revolt. Wycliffe's doctrine of dominion or lordship could all too easily be interpreted as a license for the oppressed to rise up against their oppressors, even though Wycliffe himself rejected that particular interpretation. Well, in the wake of the peasants' revolt and its defeat, Wycliffe's old enemy, Bishop Courtney of London, replaced the murdered Sudbury as Archbishop of Canterbury. And he then began to institute proceedings against Wycliffe. So in 1382, Courtney summoned a church council which condemned 24 propositions taken from the writings of Wycliffe. The 4 main propositions that were condemned as heresy were these. 1. Christ is not physically present in the sacrament. 2. Oral confession to a priest is not necessary for a soul that is prepared for death. 3. The English church should acknowledge no pope, but be self-governing. And 4. It is contrary to scripture for the clergy to own secular possessions. Now, this church council that was convened in order to condemn Wycliffe have gone down in history as the Earthquake Synod, because of an earthquake that literally shook its deliberations. Archbishop Courtney tried to put a favourable spin on the event. The church was trying to expel Wycliffe and his errors, he said, and the earth was showing its sympathy by trying to rid itself of its winds and humours. Wycliffe interpreted the event differently. God sent the earthquake as a sign of judgment because of the council's assault on the truth. Well, Archbishop Courtney pressed ahead with the assault. He now ordered the Chancellor of Oxford University to suppress the teaching of Wycliffe throughout the university. The Chancellor, one Robert Rigg, was at first defiant, but he caved in when summoned to a personal conference with Courtney, and especially when Parliament and the King gave the Archbishop their backing. Some of Wycliffe's followers were now expelled from Oxford University, others of them recanted, and Wycliffe himself was now prohibited from preaching and teaching in the university. And so ended the Oxford career of the great reformer, and so ended the influence of his teaching in Oxford University. Having been defeated at Oxford, Wycliffe now retired to Lutterworth in the English Midlands, where he was the parish priest. And there's a photograph of the Lutterworth Parish Church there. And that's, as I say, where Wycliffe retired to now, and he spent the last 3 years of his life based there, writing popular pamphlets in which he set out his views vigorously and effectively in the English language. At the same time, he wrote a number of academic works in Latin in which he explained his views in a more scholarly manner. He organized a team of disciples to translate the Latin Vulgate Bible into English, a task that wasn't finished until after Wycliffe's death. Wycliffe himself seems to have been responsible for translating the Gospels into English. Now, the first of these biblical translations, this was the first ever complete English Bible, appeared in 1384. So, something of a landmark in English religious history, the first ever complete Bible in English. 1383, John Purvey then produced a second version in 1396 with a preface by Purvey in which he defends the right of lay Christians to have the word of God in their own language. Purvey's translation was much more popular than the 1384 version. Its use of the English language was more natural and more accessible. Now, the reaction of mainstream Catholic opinion to Wycliffe's translation of the Bible into English was one of shock and outrage. The chronicler Knighton, writing a mere 20 years after Wycliffe's death, gives a voice to this feeling. So I quote from Knighton's chronicle. "The gospel, which Christ bequeathed to the clergy and doctors of the church, as they in turn give it to lay and weaker persons, this Master John Wycliffe translated out of the Latin into the Anglican tongue, not the angelic tongue, so that by him it has become common and more open to the lay folk and to women knowing how to read than it used to be to clerics of a fair amount of learning and of good minds. Thus the gospel pearl is cast forth and trodden under foot of swine, and what was dear to both clergy and laity is now made a subject of common jest to both, and the jewel of the clergy is turned into the sport of the laity, so that what was before to the clergy and doctors of the church a divine gift has been turned into a mock gospel." This reaction against Wycliffe's English translation soon took an official shape. In 1408, a church synod at Oxford passed an act forbidding anyone, on pain of excommunication, to translate the Bible into English, unless he had received permission from his bishop. The synod specifically mentions Wycliffe's Bible as an example of an unauthorized translation. The then Archbishop of Canterbury, Thomas Arundel, was vigorous in his language. He spoke of, quote, that pestilent wretch of damnable memory, yea, the forerunner and disciple of Antichrist, who, as the complement of his wickedness, invented a new translation of the scriptures into his mother tongue. That's Arundel describing Wycliffe. Then in 1414, the very act of reading the Bible in English was forbidden, on pain of being deprived of land, cattle, life, and goods from their heirs forever. Now, despite this official hostility, Wycliffe's Bible did have a wide circulation in England in the period between its appearance and the Protestant Reformation in the 16th century. Some 235 copies of the Purvey translation have survived. This is remarkable, considering that they're all handwritten. The printing press wasn't invented until around 1450, and even then, no printer dared to print Purvey's English Bible for fear of being branded a heretic. Surprisingly, though, we find some of the handwritten copies in the possession of high-ranking members of the English establishment. King Henry VI had a copy of the Purvey Bible, which he presented to the Carthusian Monastery in London, although I'm not sure what they made of such a gift. And there was a copy of the Purvey Bible also in the possession of King Henry VII, the first Tudor monarch. And there's a portion, as it says there, of Wycliffe's Bible, and that's the kind of writing, pretty unreadable to us, but that would have been how it would have been written at the time. Now, in addition to translating the Bible into English, Wycliffe also wrote a number of English sermons on the texts that were set in the church calendar for gospel readings on Sundays. And these sermons were published in a collected volume in 1382, The Sunday Gospels Expounded in Part. They're not so much full-blown sermons as sermon outlines, which a preacher might then use as a skeleton, clothing them with the flesh of his own words. They sometimes also include directions for preachers. Let me just give you the last paragraph of the sermon for the first Sunday after Trinity, where the gospel reading is on the rich man and Lazarus. So here's Wycliffe. In this gospel may priests tell of the false pride of rich men, and of lustful life of mighty men of this world, and of long pains of hell, and joyful bliss of heaven, and thus lengthen their sermon as the time axis. And mark we how this gospel telleth that this rich man was not damned for extortion or wrong that he did to his neighbour, but for he failed in works of mercy. And thus should we warn both one man and other how some men shall be damned more fully and some shall be damned more softly for misusing of God's goods. Now, as well as writing these sermons, Wycliffe himself was committed to the ministry of preaching. The historian David Schaff, son of the great Philip Schaff, says of Wycliffe that he was, quote, by far the most notable of English preachers prior to the Reformation. Of Wycliffe's written sermons, we have some 294 in English and some 224 in Latin, which have survived and which are attributed to him. His English sermons are characterized by a straightforward, no-nonsense directness, full of clear and pointed moral and practical application. In a day like ours, where one of the cardinal sins is to be negative and critical, we may note that Wycliffe's preacher was fearlessly outspoken in naming and condemning the errors and abuses of his day. Wycliffe's estimate of the preaching office was very high, even exalted. Preaching, says Wycliffe, is the principal duty and the highest service of the pastor. Christ himself was a devoted preacher, and the pastor must imitate his Lord. The pastor's chief work, says Wycliffe, is to work a specific miracle, namely, the miracle of converting both himself and his neighbour to God and his law. If bishops, who above all men should be committed preachers, neglect this work, they are like those who murdered Christ. Preaching is a more noble and glorious work, even than celebrating the sacraments. When the gospel is preached, the church prospers and flourishes, as it was in the days of the apostles. Supreme attention should be paid to the recorded words of Christ himself, since he is the Lord and head of his church, and he has an authority far greater than anything ordained by mere men, such as the various man-made ordinances of popes and friars. Wycliffe had a special regard for the Sermon on the Mount, which in his view was adequate in itself for the guidance of human life and conduct, without any hope, any help from any man-made traditions of holiness. I think it's probably about time to have a break there. So although we haven't finished Wycliffe, we will stop at that point for lunch, and we'll resume again at 2 o'clock.